Good evening. It's wonderful to see so many friendly faces, both in the video boxes as well as in the chat. It's a pleasure to see so many alumni of our various different Sphere events. It's wonderful to see you all. Thank you all so much for taking the time to join us tonight. I'm Alan Carey. I'm the Director of Sphere Education Initiatives here at the Cato Institute. It's been wonderful to get an opportunity to work with all of you and meet you over the course of recent months. And if I haven't had a chance to interact with you yet, I'm excited to get a chance to do so soon. Tonight, I'm really excited to welcome all of you to what should be an excellent evening and a particularly interesting topic. Our topic for the evening, as you all know, is the Electoral College, History and Controversies in an Election Year. And it's a particularly exciting and timely topic for us all. We're joined again by a fantastic group of scholars and civic educators from leading education organizations across the country. Tonight, we'll be hearing from Cato's Vice President, John Samples, giving us a background on the Electoral College itself, some of the key issues and how it comes to play in a variety of different contemporary controversies, which should be fascinating, particularly as we look at engaging in this conversation just a few short weeks before the upcoming election. In addition to that, I'm really excited to be joined by some of the leading practitioners of civic education who will be offering workshops for all of you, digging into practical tools and resources that you can bring back to your classrooms. Tonight, we're once again joined by Emma Humphreys from iCivics. In addition to Emma, we also have Carrie Sautner from the National Constitution Center, and I'm pleased to welcome Rachel Humphreys from the Bill of Rights Institute as well. A couple of points as we begin the evening. First, I want to share just a little bit about the structure tonight. After my brief remarks, we'll hear from Emma Humphreys, who's going to share a little bit about how to think about this and how to frame the conversation, bringing it into your classroom. Then we'll turn it over and listen to John for about a half an hour. While John Samples is talking, what I would love for you guys to do is take an opportunity, put those questions you have in the chat box. All of your most controversial, your most difficult, the things that you're hearing from your students, the concerns that you have about how to teach it, please put them in there, because at the end of our event tonight, we're going to be using this as an opportunity to take those to do a Q&A section with John after we wrap up the workshops. After John speaks for about a half an hour, we're going to turn it over to the workshops, each of those about 15 minutes apiece. And then at the end, like I said, we're going to have a Q&A. Any of the amazing and interesting resources that your presenters share tonight, we're going to pass along after the event. But what I do ask of you guys to do is a couple of quick things for me. First of all, I would love if you could make sure that you have renamed yourself to be your actual name. So if you have not done that yet, click on participants and click the little box next to the right, rename and put in your name. That's particularly important because we use that as a means of being able to distribute the continuing education certificates that we pass out after the event. So if I have your name, that makes it much easier to match to an email address and be able to send it to you personalized with your name. And everyone attending tonight will be available for a... Cynthia, if you want to use an emoji, I'll know it was you. But for the rest of you guys, if you could put your names in, I'll pass those along as soon as I get a chance to get those made and send those out. The other thing that I would love to do tonight, and I do want to emphasize this, part of the goal of Sphere and why we bring these groups together and have these conversations is to really model and celebrate civil discourse, right? We look at civil discourse as the key foundation, the bedrock, so to speak, of a properly engaged civic community and that way to build civic culture. I bring that up in large part because what I'm especially excited about is that opportunity for each and all of you to be able to model that here. So as you're thinking about asking questions in the chat or asking questions of our moderator or engaging with each other, what I want you to do is to think, how can I model in what I'm doing now precisely the kinds of things that I hope to see from my students? How can I model it in such a way that I would be proud of the way that they engage in the conversation? And I think that's going to be so exciting for us. And so what I love about our community is that we have educators, not just from a whole variety of grade levels from elementary through high school and even some college teachers and a whole variety of different disciplines of teachers from social studies teachers to English language arts to math and special education. But even more than that, we have a wide group of people who represent a fantastic diversity of intellectual and political experiences. And so I'm eager for you all to engage with each other thoughtfully and to dig into those pieces as much as we can. So Without further ado, I want there to be much less of me and much more of the conversation and event. I'm going to turn it over to my friend and colleague, Emma Humphreys, to share a little bit about the themes for this evening's conversation.
Thank you so much. And thank you everyone for being here. It amazes me to see so many educators showing up time and time again for these opportunities. I know how hard it is to be a teacher this year, particularly a social studies teacher. So thank you. It really says something to see all of your faces here tonight. So I'm just gonna briefly set the stage and then turn it over to the person I know you really wanna hear from, Mr. John Samples. And just wanna present some sort of general themes that we'll be covering tonight. So of course, the history of the Electoral College is something we find fascinating and we like to teach our students its function and purpose, some of those basics, but we'll probably not go, I'll probably gloss over those a bit. Moving into its implications for the electoral politics. And then of course, my favorite, debates and controversies surrounding it. If you've heard me speak before, you know I love teaching controversial topics and I love engaging in civil discourse, in disagreement, but in a sort of fun and collegial way. And so we're gonna sort of set the stage by doing that here tonight. Now, my favorite debate of all debates, of all controversies in American history, has got to be the debate over the ratification of the United States Constitution, the debate between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists. And this is what I really love to do when, you know, folks say, oh, we're so polarized, we're so divisive, or politics are so fraught. Well, that's true, but they sort of have always been to some degree. And this was certainly the case when they were debating ratifying the US Constitution. So since our topic tonight is the Electoral College, it makes sense to focus in on Federalist number 68, written by Publius, who we believe is Alexander Hamilton in this case. And then Anti-Federalist number 72, written by Republicus. We're not quite sure who that is, but it was published in the Kentucky Gazette. So maybe someone around Kentucky. But both these folks wrote about the Electoral College, of course, Publius advocating for it, Republicus not. So let's start with Publius or Alexander Hamilton's words in Federalist number 68, where he's really making the case that this very interesting, complex, unique system for electing a president will ensure that the office of the president will never fall to the lot of any man who is not in eminent degree endowed with the requisite qualifications. Folks, take comfort, take care. There will be a constant probability of seeing the station filled by characters preeminent for ability and virtue. He goes on and on and on and says, you know, you could have these talents and low intrigue, of course, and make it in a single state, but to win the entire union, that's just not the case. We've developed this brilliant system. Of course, Republicus would disagree, but not on the same merits. He's more obsessed about, I'm not obsessed, upset, maybe a little obsessed too, over taking the suffrage from the hands of the free people. Why would you want to do that? Why would anyone consent to this arrangement, to giving up their vote to someone else to cast on their behalf? It is necessary, it is rational that the sacred rights of mankind should thus dwindle down to electors of electors. Taking us back to servant of servants. So you could see this was, you know, at least in the language of the time, very fraught, very controversial. And we're all left wondering, you know, what would the founders say if they were alive today? I mean, I'm really excited to hear from John, but it would be way cooler if like James Madison were here and could tell us like, all right, guys, this is, you know, here's what we intended and here's what's happening and here's what I think about that. But unfortunately, we don't have that privilege of being joined by them tonight. And honestly, even if they were here today, you know, they'd be so distracted by these devices and these ring lights and these smartphones and perhaps even the garbage disposal that I can't imagine they'd be much help. So instead, I'm going to turn it over to John Samples to tell us a little bit more about the Electoral College.
I never unmute myself, and I always think that's because I know what I should actually be doing, which is not talking. Thanks tonight. I really appreciate this. I've studied the presidential system of election in the Constitution several times. I have my views on it are pretty unusual, I think, but I will return to that toward the end when I talk about our current issues. Because basically, I think pretty much what everyone believes is in some degree wrong about this. As you know, there's no electoral college in the Constitution. What there is a way of electing the president of the United States. And that was actually a very difficult part of the Constitutional Convention. It took them a long time. It took them multiple votes. And they didn't actually reach a decision until the first half of September. So right at the end, September 17th is Constitution Day. And so right at the end, you get a decision about it. And that is the system we have here. Now, during that period, they rejected and considered and rejected two other forms, although governors were also considered. But the two major contenders were that Congress would elect the president. This was thought to be a problem on separation of powers grounds, because the Congress would control the presidency, or on corruption grounds. That is, that you get a president who would essentially buy off Congress to become president. So those two concerns meant, and I think maybe the, you know, if you wanted to separate powers, having the one branch elect the other is not going to work very well. It's not, you're going to have a tendency to mix the powers. So election by Congress wasn't the real possibility, but the other one was a popular vote, and the popular vote did come up, but it's a somewhat disappointing result, I think, because in a way we don't recognize why they rejected the popular vote. Now, it's true that many people, including Hamilton, but others, thought that the masses weren't capable of making a good decision. That is, they just thought that you needed this indirect, this elite system, because the average person was going to make a poor choice. It is also true there were people, Gouverneur Morris being the most famous one, most prominent person at the convention, who thought a direct election by a majority was a good idea. So it was a mixed bag. The real issue, though, I think that carried the day was people at the convention were concerned that there was nobody, they were thinking beyond George Washington, right? And after Washington served two terms, they thought nobody would have a national stature that would enable them to win the election. So what you would end up with is a bunch of separate candidates, no one of which commanded very much of a following from all the separate states and formerly colonies. So the direct election was problematic because, oddly enough, given our media and our nationalized media and all of that, is that they didn't think there would be a nationalized kind of convention or a nationalized candidate. So you end up with a system that is, as you may have noticed in the Hamilton quote, has something to do with elites. I was talking to this man, Michael Glennon, a friend of mine who wrote a book on the Electoral College, and he referred to the original idea as a blue ribbon commission idea of electing a president. You get a bunch of people together who are trusted for maybe, and they're also local, they're trusted for their expertise. And they, they know who the good people are, and they can come together ultimately and elect a president. So it's a way of solving what was thought to be a knowledge problem, but it's very much elite in that sense. The electors, and it's an indirect system. That in itself doesn't condemn it, because there's lots of indirect systems we deal with every day. But over time, of course, it became more problematic. So you end up with this system that is approved and ratified. And the system is every state legislature is the core of the system. Every state gets electors equal to their representation in Congress. So whatever their house, which is based on population, or maybe for the last 50 years have been strictly based on population. And then you add two senators, two votes, two electoral votes for every state. And that, whatever that number is, the state legislature gets to decide how to allocate it. Now, that means, you know, they could do it by a coin flip if they wanted to, or coin flips. They could do it any number of ways, right? But it's this up to the state legislature. And then they decide, those electors are picked, and then they ultimately vote for the president. Now, this has the interesting and somewhat now meaningless, but still interesting idea is that there is actually no right to vote for the president in the United States Constitution, because in a state could constitutionally decide to ignore the popular vote, and there's no necessary relationship between the popular vote and the electoral casting of electoral votes. Now, in truth, of course, beyond this, in subsequent times, the United States Constitution really takes the path of eliminating reasons to disenfranchise people, right? So you don't have a positive right to vote for president, but there, you can't exclude people for a bunch of reasons. But if you ever hear that, that's why people say it. It's the electoral system doesn't have a necessary. Now, in fact, it turns out to be quite important how people vote. Now, I'll get to that in a minute. I should just mention in passing, the system almost immediately goes awry in the election of 1800. There's an equal number of votes for Thomas Jefferson and for Aaron Burr, who is his vice presidential candidate. The system was not, the party, the Jeffersonian Republican Party, tried to fix the, what happened was they got in the actual initial voting, they both got an equal number of votes, even though Burr was the vice presidential candidate. It then went to the House of Representatives, and then there was an attempt to try to pull Jefferson through at that point, and you got into a long multiple round of voting. It was a near crisis of the Republic. So the 12th Amendment to the Constitution fixes that. People vote for, the electors vote for either a president or a vice president. The two are distinguished. The system was far from perfect at the beginning, from the beginning, right? You have problems almost immediately. The other thing I would say about it is note the fallback provision is the Congress. So if one candidate does not get a majority of the electoral votes, what happens is it goes to the House of Representatives. Now, one of the amazing things, I think, in all this history is in the 20th century, you have four very strong third-party candidates, three of whom get electoral votes, win some states, and vote, and you know, as recently as 1992, a third party candidate got 20% of all the vote, and yet none of those elections get thrown into the House of Representatives. We came close in 2000, but that wasn't directly because of a third party candidate. So the House generally stays out of it. It still looms. And by the way, if it did happen in about 3 weeks, if there was no winner at the end of all of the voting in the Electoral College, it's very likely that Mr. Trump would be back for another 4 years, because the voting in the House is by state. The states each decide how they will cast their single ballot. Each state cast a single ballot, and Republicans dominate or have a majority in about it's something like 28, 22, 27, 23. So they have a clear majority. However, I would add to that, if for some reason this makes you feel anxious, that the reason you're not going to have, and let's hope, you know, I mean, I'm about to tell you this isn't going to happen. So if it does happen, you'll remember me forever, I suppose, is the person that said that. But it's very unlikely, because you need a strong third party candidate. Somebody's got to win some electoral votes to prevent the person from having a majority, one person candidate or the other, in a two-party system. And it doesn't seem that we're anywhere near that at this point. It could be, of course, that the system could go off the rails in other ways, and you just don't have people reporting. You don't make a decision about some states, and that way someone, that almost happened in 2000. The question of whether you have a decision early enough is another one. And if somebody doesn't report, some state doesn't report their electoral votes, and that's enough to prevent someone from having a majority, you could very well end up in the House. But again, I think that's unlikely this time. Now, so I'm going to skip ahead, make one stop between 1800 and now, and that stop is going to be in 1840. Notice again, the crucial thing is how electors allocate, or excuse me, how state legislatures allocate the electors they have, which is the number they have is provided by the Constitution. And I went through some fanciful things about how they might do that. But the fact is, starting about 1840 or so, and increasingly so, and almost completely now, they have all choose the same method, which is winner take all. So I'm sitting here in South Bay, California, Menlo Park. And, you know, I suspect what will happen in a few weeks is that Joseph Biden will get maybe 60% or more of the vote in California. And President Trump will get 40% or less. And Mr. Biden will get 100% of California's really large electoral college hall. And that's true everywhere, right? Except for two states, Maine and Nebraska. There's been other states other times, but not much. Almost all states pursue the winner-take-all system, right? And that's because of the rise of political parties, which weren't on the agenda really at the Constitution. And they prefer a system, both parties prefer a system in which if you win a state, you win all of the electoral votes. This has other implications in a variety of ways that I want to go into now. But the crucial thing is the actual way the system works is not the way it was meant to, because that sort of starts falling apart pretty quickly. The elite leaders of the community voting on presidential candidates, that really doesn't last very long. And for most of our history, we've tended toward this system of winner take all, in which the popular vote in a state determines who wins it. And that's the one we have now, and it has big implications. So note again, the other thing I would say is we have a system that looks one way, is designed in one way, and was meant to deal with a certain need for compromise at the convention that has evolved into something else, right? And the Senate itself is somewhat like that too, but it was changed by constitutional amendment. Now, let's go to the current issues, which I will go over and talk about a little bit. So one thing you hear about, people are the great alternative to today, as in some ways 1789, the great alternative to the way we elect the president, the Electoral College, is the national popular vote, a direct majority, Americans, all Americans vote, whoever gets a majority wins. So one argument against national direct vote and the Electoral College you often hear is that it protects small states. And that was certainly a concern in 1789. And to some extent, it is true. Every state gets two however your size, and it's not just, so the election of the president is just not a population contest. So in a sense, from a point of view of arithmetic, small states might be worse off. But on the other hand, the electoral votes are not equal for every state. Every state doesn't vote as a state. There is also, you get your House representation, and since the House has been basically one person, one vote for, as I said, 50 years or so, you really have a situation where population matters a great deal, particularly when you have states that are huge. And by the way, much the difference between the state with the largest population and the smallest population now is much greater than it was in 1789. You know, California and then the New Yorks are much, much bigger than Wyoming, than the small and large states originally. So population matters still a great deal. The weights of the votes are different. That makes people upset, but still it's only a marginal kind, in my view, a marginal kind of limit on the power of large states. So the small state argument is actually, I think, not that strong. There's something to it, but it's not a big argument. The other one is that the Electoral College is crucial for federalism and keeping the states as having an important role in the system. Now, I think that's true in one way, which I will go into, but it's not true in general. That is the system, that is the idea that the states would retain power, that you would really have a state-oriented system such as you did in 1789, or you did really well into the 20th century, I would say. It's not clear that the Electoral College at all has done much to preserve that system or would prevent less centralization, would prevent more centralization of power. It seems that the president, there's other factors at stake and so on. So in that regard, in general, I don't think Electoral College does a lot. I would say, though, that there is one thing I think that's actually crucial that would preserve state power in the system. But it, if you went to a direct majority system, and that is, if you go to direct election of the president by a national popular majority, what will follow eventually is a national election commission, such as you have in the states, for deciding who won the election, deciding the rules, all those kinds of things. And you could see why that would be. You will have a national election rather than an election that's in a number of 50 different states. And so I think what will follow is you'll need a national commission to do the bureaucratic carrying out of rules, to work with Congress on those. And so you will be a centralization of national power in the federal government over elections. Now, maybe that's good, but it has advantages and disadvantages, but it to me, it's risky in the following sense. If you centralize that kind of power in one national institution that has the power to, you know, potentially to affect the outcome of the presidential elections, a very powerful office, you also have the potential for people to try to affect, influence, control that institution. It's harder now to do it because there's lots of different kinds of 50 different election commissions. And you would run the risk of, I think it becomes more risky, and not necessarily anything bad's going to happen, but certainly it is true also that states would lose power. They would become less important in the process. The other point I would make about states is, and small states in particular, is to return to the effect of the winner take all. The people, the states that actually matter in the system we have, as it actually works, are not small states, or they're not large states, populous states, or non-populous, or any of that, Western, Eastern, regional. The states that matter are the states that can give a winning presidential candidate the 271st electoral vote to win. So California doesn't matter, and maybe Texas will matter soon, but not now, because they're both known to go to in California's case, the Democrats, Texas's case, the Republicans. There's other states like that. Utah is a very strong Republican state, and so on. So those states sort of just are assumed to be true, but you've got to work to 271. You can't win with just those states. So the result is, whichever state it is that can give you 271, and we call these states in the media, they're called battleground states, right? They are the state, they're battleground states because those are the ones who, whoever wins them is more likely to win the presidency. They, the system we have, gives them immense power because they can determine who wins. And Keith Winnington, a political scientist at Princeton, has shown that this matters. Presidential candidates pay attention to these states, and there's more rewards from Congress coming their way after an election. So everyone wants to be a battleground state. Now you can say over time, the battleground states are going to change. Some states are going to become less competitive, some more competitive, and that's probably true. But the system we have is one, the important thing is the system that started out thinking that you were helping small states and thinking that it was a kind of elite system has become one in which the most important states that matter are states that are closely competitive. The other side I would say to that, and before I move on, is this means that someone like me, who I temporarily here in California. I live more or less all the time, or permanently. My permanent residence is in the District of Columbia. Both of these places have electoral college votes, or electoral votes for the presidency. And I have absolutely no reason to vote, because unless I just want to, because I think it's my duty or something like that. But if there is no chance at all that whatever I do can change the outcome of the election. We know what the outcome of the presidential election is going to be in California and DC and so on and so forth. This is thought to be a major argument against this system, is that it drives down turnout and some people's votes really don't matter a great deal because they're not going to affect the outcome. The people in the battleground states become very important, and whether they're Democrat, Republican, or whatever, it doesn't really matter. It's who they vote for that matters. But for the states that are by, even how big the population is, it doesn't really matter because they are not going to vote for the other candidate, and therefore their outcome is known. Now, other issues, minority winners. You know, it's a funny thing about minority winners. That is, the system we have allows for the possibility of a person winning the presidency and finish second in the popular vote. And that had happened fairly rarely until 2000. And even then, when it happened in 2000, really distinguished political scientists like Gary King did the math, the statistics on it, and said, look, even though it happened in 2000, this probably only happens once a century. And so it's not really something to worry about. You can change the system, but you shouldn't be thinking this is a major flaw because it'll happen about once a century. Well, it happened again in 2016 for a variety of reasons. So we now have a situation where minority or winners who finish second, in fact, to the other, have a finished second in the really the two-party vote or whatever, the number of votes cast. And so that has become something that looks like it's going to happen a lot more. And the additional problem with it is this, which is it looks like it's actually a partisan advantage, right? So we've had two winning candidates who finished second in the popular vote, one by 500,000 votes and one by 3 billion. And I would say, you know, it's also the case, 500,000 out of 125 million is something. It's a large absolute number. Proportionally, it's not a big number. 3 million is starting to get to be a big number, right? Both absolutely and proportionally. You have a situation in which this looks like an institutional advantage for one of the parties, which then has implications for changing the system. Now, I would say also, this is probably rooted in the way, in the choices of where people live. Democrats, as it were, waste a large number of votes because Democrats live closer to one another. And so you end up winning California by 3 million, but you only really needed 10,000. You want to, basically the idea is you take those, 2.5 million or whatever, and you move them somewhere else. You'll do better in the presidential election, but that's not something anyone's going to do. But that's the problem, right? So the real question I think here is, how much do people mind this system? People finishing second become president in through the electoral process, and how much do people mind it? And that's a complicated question. In part, it's a partisan question, I think, because people's partisan views in the world we live in tend to produce other views. But there's also this is where the battleground states matter. It's whether if you're a battleground state, whether you're a Democratic or Republican, doesn't really matter. You like the system because it rewards you, right? And this too. So I don't know that they're going to care a lot, the battleground states, if they're going to be a battleground, if you're in Florida or whatever. You know, you're going to like the system because it's good for you. So I don't know where I am at this point, but on timing, I don't want to go on too long.
You actually just ran to the end of the time, so it worked out perfectly. Well, any quick closing remarks?
Well, there's problems I'd like to return to: the prospects for change, the question of slavery, and the question of so-called faithless electors. So maybe we can get back to that in a little bit.
Absolutely. John, thank you so much for that excellent introduction in history of the Electoral College, as well as some of the many controversies around it. Like John mentioned, there's so many additional things to talk about. Please, if we haven't hit one that you are interested in digging in more, throw it into the chat, and John and I will make sure to bring it back up in the Q&A section at the end. What I wanted to do now is to turn the conversation over to our fantastic presenters from the civic education organizations that we have with us here tonight. Kicking us off is going to be Emma Humphreys from iCivics. Emma, go ahead and take it away.
Yeah, thank you so much. That was lots of fun. And I have so many questions, like folks in the chat, and so many things to say. And I hope you all are able to have conversations as exciting as this in your own classroom. So I'm just going to give a little insight into some relevant iCivics resources that we have. Of course, we have a full library of over 260 resources covering the full gamut of civics and government, but I thought I'd try to stay topical tonight and focus on our elections related resources and then really home in on those electoral college related resources. So the good news is you don't have to look around too much to find these things. We created an elections headquarters. It's easy to get to from our homepage. There's a big blue banner at the top, or you can just type in this very specific icivics.org/election URL, and it'll take you right there. And it's sort of one-stop shopping for all of our materials. So I want to highlight just a couple of really cool, relevant ones. And then, like I said, I'll dig a little deeper into the Electoral College and what we have on that. So if you joined us last time, I talked about our new infographic series, our tough and timely infographic series. So we take topics that are sort of tough to teach and timely in that they're coming up in the news or otherwise relevant because, say, it's an election year. So we have one on campaign cash that's all about where the money comes from and what it's used for in campaigns. At least when I was an AP government teacher, teaching about campaign finance wasn't really my favorite topic. I didn't not like it, but it wasn't my favorite. So it would be great to have a resource like this to make it a bit more accessible for students. Another one we have is running for president. Like I said earlier, we have this really complex, unique system for doing that in the United States, which I think is what makes it so fun to be a government teacher. I mean, it's definitely part of the challenge of being a government teacher, but also super interesting because what we teach and what we have to be experts in is really complex and really sort of fascinating. And of course, you can see here the Electoral College is one of the columns here in this race to be the next president. Really good news, we're not done. We're coming in under the wire here. We're gonna be putting out two new infographics in the coming weeks. The first one will be on public opinion polling. This is particularly timely. I even saw a comment in the chat about polling. There's a lot of controversy around what happened in 2016 and people assuming that the polls got it completely wrong. And I think there were a lot of sampling errors made to be sure, but I think fundamentally it comes down to a misunderstanding about the purpose of polls. They're not crystal balls. They don't predict the future. They are just one data point, one sort of piece of evidence used to make a prediction, but it's certainly, they don't represent a prediction of the future themselves. So we'll cover that and sampling and their uses. And then we will cover the peaceful transfer of power. Shortly after the controversy over the president's tweets, we got a lot of requests for materials covering this topic. I happily pointed folks to some great resources from some of my co-presenters today at the Bill of Rights Institute and National Constitution Center. But I'm happy to report that we'll be putting out an infographic on the peaceful transfer of power and coming at it from precedent, tradition, and legitimacy, and how these three things sort of come together to create this culture of a peaceful transfer of power. So stay tuned, coming soon. We also have a great lesson plan. This is brand new. It's sort of maybe a month and a half old. It's a high school level lesson plan called Popular versus President. It's all about, as you can imagine, the Electoral College. And what I'd like to highlight about this lesson is the amount of ground it covers. This is not a lesson plan for a 30-minute class period or a 50-minute class period, if you're so lucky these days to have that kind of time with your students. It covers a lot of ground, as you can see just from the reading. It starts with what is the Electoral College and how many votes go to states. We go to the historical reasons for why we have it, how electors vote, what happens if they're a tie. Is there's a tie? What happens when the national popular vote and the electoral vote are don't give us the same results? What does that mean for my vote? Should the system change? We wade into the controversy. We really keep it nonpartisan and really try to present a balanced perspective on this. And then we have a bunch of activities, like 5 different activities. Again, this lesson plan covers so much ground, and you can sort of pick and choose. You don't have to use all the activities with students. One is where you look at these little mini case studies. You see this on the left of your screen, these little mini case studies. And you sort of have to decide, like, should someone from that state be in favor or against, and why? And of course, there's no right answer there. It's based on the student's reasoning, as long as they have good evidence. There's this other little case study approach about where you have to sort of figure out which state the person's from, how many electors they have, and then are they a red state, a blue state, a battleground state? How would you sort of define or identify that state? And we're still not done. We go through some big elections in history and have students try to figure out what happened there and why. This is really a fascinating study on the Electoral College. Move over to the right of your screen. You see we bring in Federalist 68, written by Alexander Hamilton. What did the founders have to say themselves on this system? So they read this snippet from the Federalist Papers. There's more long form questions on that topic. And then we wade into the current controversy with 3 different buckets for research for students to sort of start to make sense of their views. So what are the arguments for and against? And then maybe that will help students have a more informed view, again, using that evidence to inform their opinion. So this is a super loaded lesson plan. I don't usually spend time presenting on one single lesson plan, but this one has so much bang for its buck, and I wanna make sure that you know it's there for you and for your students. So moving right along, I have to take a moment and talk about our popular game, Win the White House. What I love about this game is that it takes one of the most complex topics in American government to teach, the Electoral College, and teaches it to students by playing a game. And I always love to tell my first political memory. I know a lot of you have heard me talk about this before. So I was so excited when John brought up the 1992 election, because that is my first political memory. I was a little girl in my childhood home in my living room, and I'm watching the returns come in, and I don't get it at all. I do not understand why that rich guy from Texas was getting all these electoral votes, I'm sorry, all these popular votes, but not a single electoral vote. And imagine my father, a blue-collar worker, still had his construction boots on for the day, trying to explain to me, a precocious 9-year-old, why that's the case and how this works and how we elect the president. I bet he really wished he had won the White House. You just park me in front of the computer, which we didn't even have one then. Park me in front of that computer and play this game, kiddo, and then you'll get it. So I'm going to quickly play the trailer here and then talk about some of the resources we have supporting this game.
The team that brought you the 2016 blockbuster election game, Win the White House, is back. Learn where the rubber meets the road during election season. Win the White House puts you in charge of your own presidential campaign. Create a candidate, pick a slogan, and get ready to jump into the primaries. Do you know where you stand on the issues? Updated for the next election season and beyond, pick issues that matter to you and add them to your campaign. Travel in style as you raise funds for your campaign efforts. Poll states to see your level of support and what issues have traction. Make personal appearances and run media campaigns to capture voters' attention.
Breaking news, this party is on a roll.
Gain momentum, flip states, and keep an eye on the electoral vote tally as the decision day draws near. Can you win the White House?
So So I always sort of joke that I can't win the White House because I'm always playing it while presenting. And that's like really hard and distracting to do. So I never win. I always have the worst scores ever. If I ever pop into one of my saved games, it's really embarrassing. But what I know a lot of teachers love to do is to play it and get a really high score and print out or otherwise, you know, screenshot their game certificate at the end and make that the score to beat for the class. And it's incredible to see how these kids will keep playing and keep playing and keep playing to get to the top of the class leaderboard or to just beat Mr. David Olson, their AP government teacher in Madison, Wisconsin. And I'm naming him by name because I know he does this every year and his kids are so motivated to beat him. They'll play so many times until they do that. So can't recommend this game enough. It's really engaging. It's replayable. You can play as a different party. You can choose different issues to focus on. You can figure out new strategies as you play the game. It's really a new game every time you play it. And again, we just updated it for 2020. It's new art, it's new issues, not all new issues, but issues have been refreshed and updated for 2020. There's new features added to the game. And you can play in Spanish. If you have Spanish speaking students, ELLs, or just bilingual students, that's a really cool thing. You can sort of bounce back and forth if you want and play in both languages. So really dynamic game. I assure teachers that after playing this game one or two times, students really sort of get the Electoral College because you're working the map in order to win the game. And it's just by the end, you get it. And you know, I'm all for like putting up that big C-SPAN map. I always had that big map in my classroom. That's what I used to use, that and like a whiteboard and my stories, but it's really cool to be able to park kids in front of a game and let them play and play until they get it. So I want to say that the game stands alone, and if nothing else, just assign the game. But we like to support teaching around the game because we know the games are more meaningful when they're part of a coordinated learning sequence. And this is our very sophisticated, very intellectual approach here, our pedagogical approach here at iCivic, the game sandwich. So everyone stay with me if you can, all right? So the bread is like the stuff that before and after. I know I'm just being ridiculous. So, okay. So we'd like to provide these materials as we know how busy you are. I see the Facebook posts and the tweets that, you know, it's 11 o'clock on Sunday night and you still don't feel prepared for the week ahead. We know how hard it is to be a teacher this year again. And so we want to provide all those materials to teach around the game, starter activities, mini lesson, then you have the kids play the game, then you have that post-game activity and then an assessment, and it's all built in here. So what I'm going to do really quick is stop sharing my screen so that I can share a different part of my screen, which will be the iCivic homepage, just to show you how to navigate to all of these things. And just make life a little bit easier. So you see here, visit our elections headquarters. This is right here on the iCivics.org homepage. So one-stop shopping for all of these things. In case anyone's wondering, there are 19 days, 4 hours, 41 minutes, and 14, 13, 12 seconds left until the election, but who's counting? One-stop shopping, folks, you have our new Student Power Elections resource. I talked about this at the last webinar, so I'm not gonna focus on it here, but I just wanna say it's a great new resource. It was designed by students, for students. It can be directly downloaded by students without a login. I know Julie or someone's gonna paste that URL for you to go directly to that so you can find it, but everything's here on this election headquarters page. In honor of the VP debate, we posted a mini lesson on the vice presidency. Here's all of our elections related games, lesson plans on the topic, and there are more. We're just featuring some here and we try to refresh this from time to time. We have a candidates guide. This is pretty neat. It shows the four sort of big ticket candidates. Actually, I can just show you really quickly. Here we go. Whoops. Maybe not really quickly. And I know I'm watching time, Alan, I promise. So download resources, take a look here. And you can see here we're covering, I couldn't remember Howie and Joe's name. So that's why I had to pull this up. So I'm totally cheating, but we have guides and we have this grid here telling you all about them. Let me go back really quickly. Here's all those awesome infographics. So when we make our new one, on public opinion polling and on the transfer of power, you will find those here. Check out our new one on gerrymandering, it's awesome. We have web quests and we have blogs and news and all that stuff. So everything you need is right here on this election headquarters. And one last thing I'm gonna show you, when you go to that Win the White House page, this is where you'll find the link to our extension pack and our new Win the White House family guide. Folks, I know it's really scary to be teaching through a computer when you know there's other people at home watching, listening. So invite them in, tell them that you're teaching about the election, invite them to talk about it with their students, send them, download, email them the Win the White House Family Guide and encourage them to have these discussions. Give them more resources than my poor father had in 1992 to help their kids make sense of the Electoral College. And I think that's my time, so I will end there.
Emma, thank you so much. With that, we're going to turn it right over to Curry Sautner from the National Constitution Center. Curry, please take it away.
Thanks. I am going to do a little screen sharing myself and jumping around, so hopefully I won't make you nauseous. Let me just adjust my screen. Emma, I just got so excited of all the stuff that you have that I almost forgot to unmute myself because I was over here yelling in the corner. I love this night. I love this conversation. It is amazing to start out with a great lecture and then watch other people in civic education and all the cool stuff they're doing. So I hope I fit into that civic sandwich of Emma and Rachel really well and kind of fill in a little bit of the pieces. So just to give you 2 seconds on who I am, who we are. My name is Curry Sautner. I'm with the National Constitution Center. I'm their chief learning officer. And we are having such an exciting year, like all of us are, trying to make a whole bunch of lemonade with everything that everybody's going through. So we've decided to do different programs and different products and really just bust out election month and really lead up to November 3rd and what we're really thinking might be election day week and what's gonna happen around that time. So a little bit about the Constitution Center, if you don't know us, we are a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that has a museum in Philadelphia, but has a national presence on civic education. If you ever come to Philadelphia, this is what our building lot looks like, and I am always there. And so please let us know if you wanna come visit. We are open right now, but I know it might be a little hard to travel. Makes sense, a lot of things going on. Now we do lots of different programs. We have programs, like I said, in civic education, and I'm gonna walk you through those that you can plug and play into your classroom and take our tools, cut them up, use them in any way that works for you, and then let us know what other tools you want us to support you with. We're here to help, that's our job. But we also have town halls and podcasts and the museum. So we have lots of programs for adults. So if you'd like to come to the center as an adult without your students, you can do that too, virtually or physically, either one, we're there to help you. Our learning theory at the National Constitution Center, you know, it's really based in this idea that, you know, we all learn best through storytelling. And we understand that if we want to get a great grasp on the way things were, how they work today, and why they are what they are, we need to understand the story and told through the lens of we the people. Who are the people around it? Who are the people that play into it? And then how does it affect we the people today? And that is the basis of every single thing we do at the museum, through our town hall, and throughout all of our civic education work. The next thing we do is look for those constitutional thinking skills. We pose everything we do as big constitutional questions. We ask students to take the political questions, and they're typically, should we do this? Should we do that? And we ask them to put them aside for a minute and look at those constitutional questions. What may the government do? What does the Constitution give the government the power to do? Where does it say it may not do that? So we start there with our students. That's our mandate, that's our mission, to do it in a nonpartisan way. But everything we do is wrapped around that. So when you come to one of our programs and we're looking at the Electoral College, we're looking at the history behind it, where the ideas came from, and then what are the current debates around it today? And what are those Electoral College connections? And what are the changes or not changes that we would have around it? The final thing that we do in everything that we do is civil dialogue and reflection. We want kids, we want adults, we want everybody to talk to each other. And that's my favorite part of what we do. We try to bring people from around the country together to have dialogues around these big constitutional questions. And what makes it so wonderful and so great is that we all put the big constitutional question on the table and we talk about it together. And we're watching right now students from across the country do that online with each other and teachers from around the country doing that online with each other and listening to different perspectives and understanding, well, you know what? I hear where you're coming from and I see where you're coming from and we're talking about the Constitution. So real quick, kind of those constitutional questions, thinking like that constitutional lawyer, those policy questions again start with, should a public school principal, search a student's locker. You may say no. You may say yes, all those things. But the constitutional question that we're going to ask around this is, does the Fourth Amendment allow the government employee, and again, there's the government employee there, like a public school principal to search a student's locker? We talk to kids about this. We start with yes, no, maybe, I need more information. And then you get really excited when the fifth grader turns around and goes, well, when was it happening? Where was it happening? And what was the search like? And I'm like, oh, you just nailed time, place, and matter, kid. Nice job. So how do we do this? And you can see it. It's amazing. They may not know the legal terminology, but they're totally doing the action. And that behavior is important. So let's dive into, I'm going to do a flip screen share real quick. I'm going to stop share, get y'all a little nauseous, and then go back to full screen share and show you kind of some of the things that we can do. If I pick the right one, it's always questionable. Nope, I don't want that one. Sorry. I'm going to do it to you one more time. Let's do this, a walkthrough on the website. So this is where everything that we do on the Constitution Center is on our website. It's free and it's there to help you. All the programs that we do are free. And even the museum experience, we have huge amount of work that goes into making scholarships so teachers can come in the summer for our summer teacher workshops, and students can come during the year for free as well. There is paid prices, but there are tons of scholarships. So what I'm gonna do is walk you through these resources that are online. Number one, our biggest resource, and millions of views since we've redone it in the last year, I think we're at 30,000 views. We're the fourth most visited website in the world because of this interactive constitution. So you go to the interactive constitution, I pulled up the elections clause, Article 1, Section 4, because what I wanted to pull out there is this idea of time, place, matter for elections. Where can they happen? Why can they happen? I'm so obsessed with connecting the dots between federalism and the election, federalism and the president, you know, all these things that we're constantly looking at all these ways. So you can do a search on the interactive constitution just for the Electoral College or voting rights, and we'll show you every single section. Now, what the interactive constitution is we took the constitution and we took all the sections, we took all the clauses, and then we asked the top scholars on each section and each clause to give us what we believe is the important part, civil dialogue first. So we asked the top two scholars who are ideologically opposed to write together a common interpretation, something that they both agreed on things like the election clause, things like the Second Amendment, things like the Fourth Amendment, things that we think we as Americans can agree on. We wanted the scholars to start with where they agreed upon, and that's the common interpretation. And then we asked each scholar to take a point of debate, a matter of debate, and diverge and say, okay, here's where my perspective diverges on the constitutional questions around this. So you can look at this one, and we have Morley and Fernita Tolson on this one. Really great, amazing speakers. They're on our programs all the time, but this is a short essay where they agree and where they diverge. If you want to dive into this with your students, you can find all these pieces on In the Classroom, this section right here. And what we did, because we're constitutional nerds and we own that, what we did was we broke it up by the articles, by the amendments, and then by constitutional concepts or constitutional topics. So you can see the Electoral College and you can see voting rights. So think about it. Think about if you had our great scholar, John Samples, who you heard of earlier. Think if you could just bring him into your classroom. Well, that's basically what we're doing this year. We're trying to bring top scholars from around the country and our top scholars into your classroom to teach a short and fast constitutional lesson in all these topics. If you go to the Electoral College, what you can find is that we record everything. You can find the ones that we did because we just did this last week, and we're adding Ed Puzzles to this as well as Nearpods. And then on top of it, you can find the briefing document. I think this is a great tool if you have AP students or for teachers. We ask our top scholars to write a briefing document on everything they would say around this. And you know what? They say a lot. So everything you ever wanted to know about it is right there. And then we have presentation slides that we use and our teachers were loving and our students were loving. So we shared those as well. And then every single other podcast or video or blog post that we have around it are all concentrated here. We're adding more classroom note-taking tools and infographics as well to support it. And then your connections to Article 2 are here and Article 12th Amendment for the Electoral College. You can jump to all these pieces. We have a huge listing of upcoming sessions. We hold an open public class every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. On Mondays, it's 12 and 2. 12 o'clock Eastern time is the middle school level. 2 o'clock Eastern time on Mondays is the high school level. And then the same thing on Wednesday, 12 and 2. And then Friday, what we do is we call it our Friday fun session. We're gonna have fun with this topic and we're gonna bring in scholars and historians from all different walks of life to really talk with us about these topics. So this Friday, we have the Stuff You Missed in History class, Holly Frey joining us. And Jeff and Holly are gonna talk about the history of the president and the history of the White House. We have Jamil Bowie coming up next Friday. All next week is voting rights. This week is the presidency. And then the following week is battles of the branches. Just in case our election gets a little tricky and a bunch of different branches have to jump in, we want to make sure our kids are prepared for what happens after November 4th and to look at past elections as well. You can sign up for all these pieces. We also put them on YouTube so you can join on YouTube and you can screen share into any platform you have at your school. And if you want, we can host a private session for you. So it's just for your kids. The kids can turn on their cameras and they can ask all the questions that they like. As you look through this, you can jump into all these different topics. And to just give you a real quick sneak peek, and I have no idea how much time I have, but I do have a buzzer on, sneak peek into this. We're gonna walk through in this class with the different parts of the Constitution, the 12th Amendment, and we're gonna get to all these big topics and give your students a ton of visuals to help support their learning. So they're hearing great scholars talk, they're getting tools to help them follow along, as well as questions to keep them assessing along the way. You can see, did they go to the class? How much did they learn from it? What do they still wonder about it that I need to follow up with? Great ways to dive into it. I saw this in the chat earlier, we were talking about, you know, how do you get to these numbers? But also states like California, winner take all. And then states like Nebraska, and the votes are split. And then there was a side question in the comments about like, are they split evenly? How's it done by population? And then somebody brought up gerrymandering and I got really excited. So much to talk about, not enough time is what I always say. And then for the person who asked this in the chat, we did pose the hypothetical. It was a hypothetical last year and the Supreme Court answered it. But we talked about some of these big cases around the Constitutional Convention all the way to the electoral vote. And can you be punished if you vote against what you are mandated to do as an elector? So all these things pop through. Next week, like I said, is voting rights. We'd love to have you join us for voting rights. We are really debating as an institution. When we say middle school level, we want to make sure that people know you can join at any age. I definitely have a bunch of adults that are sneaking into that one and they're sneaking in because they want that level of access. They want to be exposed to it. But the middle school level and the high school level and then the all ages level really are welcoming places. And I think my favorite part about it is that we're watching students in the chat with each other, not just us. They're joining in the conversation and we're asking them questions and then they're asking each other questions about why they're thinking about that way. What's your point? What's your area? Where did you come from that question? And the dialogue is happening from the NCC team to the students, from the students to the students. And that peer-to-peer dialogue around these hard issues like voting rights. We're at it, we have Second Amendment, we have an entire year of classes. And these are topics and issues that sometimes we feel are too hard to talk about. But what we can do as an organization is we can work with you. We can work with your classes, your schools, and your students to give you tools and supports, and also ensure, like Anna said earlier, tell your parents what they're doing and let them know you're working with nonpartisan organizations that have been mandated by acts of Congress to be nonpartisan. So we're definitely gonna do it. And we're gonna make sure that we talk about the issues, that we talk about these big questions and conversations and all these sections of the Constitution and voting rights and dive into the hard stuff and the hard history, but with presenting all sides so we understand different perspectives and can hear the value in that and not shying away from it, but also making sure that our kids understand and they're diving deep into these difficult questions around who was part of the Declaration of Independence and who was allowed to vote and where does the Constitution give power? So my favorite conversation so far this week, and they're on the recorded exchanges, you can find everything we do on here. It's all about the presidency. So we did a poll of our students who had signed up, and they definitely wanted to know all about the presidency. We made sure we walked them through the Constitution and where the power and the job and the duties of the president is in the Constitution. And then we step into the discussion and debate around the presidency at the Constitutional Convention. And then we spend the second half of the class talking about presidential powers and executive orders, because that's what the students were most confused about. That's what the students wanted to understand. And they wanted to understand that lens of it. So we dove in deeply to that and jumped in. So last week on the Electoral College, diving in really deep and looking closely at the Electoral College and the pro and con conversations around it. But I will have to say my favorite part was absolutely the election of 1800. Because if it makes you feel stressed today about what's going on with elections, just read up on that one again. You'll feel way better about it. It really does kind of settle you. One other thing I wanted to show you on this, and I think I'm about out of time, but Alan, you holler because my timer didn't work.
You have about one minute left, Curry.
Perfect. That was actually good timing. So what I did was I made you guys a PowerPoint where I linked everything in it. And then on this final slide, and I'll put it in the chat box in a second, I made a bit.ly so you could find the PowerPoint. Everything about the NCC is hyperlinked in the title. And then on the notes page of this slide below is every single link I just walked you through, so you can go right to it and not have to freak out or stress out that I didn't give you everything I was showing you, because I know I just zoomed you through it. It's like speed dating with the NCC on the Electoral College and voting rights. So thank you guys so much. My name is Curry Sautner. If you need anything from me, our NCC, our job is here to serve. So you let us know, we're here to help. One really quick little thing I'll tell you before we go. We did just launch a new Teachers Advisory Council, and we're looking for hundreds of teachers from around the country. So check out our professional development page and check out that Teachers Advisory Council. And if you're interested, you can email us or just fill out the survey and we'll reach out to you. So thank you guys so much. There's a speed version of it. And back to you, Ellen.
Curry, thank you so much. Those are fantastic resources as always. There's a ton of demand for them in the chat and a couple of questions. I think Leslie hit them, but if there's someone she missed, please by all means jump in there. Our third workshop for tonight is gonna be presented by Rachel Davison Humphreys from the Bill of Rights Institute. And without any further ado, Rachel, I'll just let you jump right into it.
Well, thank you. Yes, thank you so much. It's hard to follow Curry and Emma. They are dear friends of mine. My name is Rachel Davison Humphreys. I'm Director of Outreach at the Bill of Rights Institute. I've been with the Institute 4 years, and I'm so glad to be back at the Sphere Summit. I was actually, for those of you that were in person 2 years ago, Leslie, a year and a half ago, I was part of that fantastic in-person session and helped Leslie kind of think through some of the pedagogical principles that build these kinds of experiences. So I was a classroom teacher for almost 10 years prior to coming to the Bill of Rights Institute. And I'm really, really glad to be here. So thank you. Thank you for joining me. I wasn't a part of this past summer's presentations because I was on parental leave. I have a beautiful new baby girl who is about 3.5 months old, because right on brand, she was born on the 4th of July at about 10:30 at night. And so I was hearing the fireworks as she was going, as she was entering our lives. And it was quite a joyous experience to have that work out that way. You can't plan such things. So I'm really grateful. So I'm glad to be back. I'm glad to see all the teachers. I'm glad to see all of you. The Bill of Rights Institute has been around for a little over 20 years now, and for all of that time, we have focused on teacher educational resources, so providing you with resources. Unlike iCivics, we don't have a lot of games, and unlike NCC, we don't have a museum, but we are similar in that we love our educators, and we are here to serve and to create value for you. We design our resources around constitutional principles. That's the foundation of all the work that we do. And all of our resources are free for educators. So not only do we have over 3,000 digital resources, but we also do professional development. And I'm going to walk you through some of those resources right now with a little bit of a screen share. But I am very cognizant of the fact that I am standing between you and the scholar. So I will make this nice and short so you can get to those amazing questions, because the Electoral College is tricky. BRI's tagline is educating for self-governance. For those of you that have been with the Bill of Rights Institute for a long time, you'll know that about 6 years ago, we got a new president, Dr. David Bob. And as part of that, we've kind of been expanding and refining our mission at the same time. And so we focused on educating for self-governance. And what is at the heart of the American project, and at the heart of, in many ways, what it means to be an educator. And so all of our resources are designed, like I said, with those constitutional principles and virtues in mind. And we're always designing new things, including a brand new website. So there are a ton of resources that the Bill of Rights Institute has developed over the past 20 years, and they are a little bit locked into a kind of not super beautiful website, unlike what Curry and Emma were showing you. So I'm not going to spend much time on our website, because on Bill of Rights Day, December 15th, the Bill of Rights Institute is getting a brand new website. So if you sign up for resources, you'll hear all about that. We're putting together a big celebration to introduce you all to all the new features of the new website. In the meantime, I want to let you know about a few of the resources that we've been developing. So for those of you that love podcasts, as many of us do these days, as we're walking the dog so we can get out of the house a little bit, the Bill of Rights Institute has our Fabric of History podcast that we started last year. You can find it on all the podcast, on all the podcast feeders. What the Fabric of History podcast does is it takes historical concepts or historical periods and has a really fun, rich conversation about them. So we have about 20 episodes already. We're about 10 episodes already. We're in season two. And you can kind of see here that they run the gamut of thinking about the 4th of July or the bearded presidents or the Salem witch trials, really just fun history for everyone kind of resources. The other thing the Bill of Rights Institute has been doing over the past year and a half, 2 years, is really focusing on our YouTube channel and YouTube subscribers. So we recognize that so many students are on YouTube so much that it's a space that they're so native to, that in order to reach them cleanly and quickly, it's a space we should be in. So we have a number of different shows or playlists. Our popular one is Primary Source Close Read with the Bill of Rights Institute, where a scholar goes through a primary source excerpt with you in a really close, detailed way. We had during March and April, we had what we were calling Bright and Early, which was a civics and history kind of morning show for students on a variety of different topics. But our keynote resources are our homework help series. Our homework help series is a series of videos that either looks at an issue or a Supreme Court case and gives students a really clean, quick overview. It's a great introductory resource. And we also catalog all the other things we do. So our webinar series and our free AP prep webinars. But I want to take you into the Electoral College one right now. Unfortunately, I remember I didn't optimize for screen share. So hold on just a second. I'm going to stop the share, then restart it with optimizing for the video. There we go. So we're going to watch a short video right now on the Electoral College. This has been a pretty popular video since it premiered in June. And I'll let it run for about 6 minutes and then I'll come back.
Years on the night of the presidential election, much attention is paid to what's called the Electoral College, and with good reason, as it's a crucial part of selecting our nation's president. So, what exactly is this Electoral College? What is its function? How did it come to be? And what role does it play in our constitutional system? That's what we discuss today. This is the Electoral College.
In order to understand the Electoral College, we must first go back all the way to the American Revolution. Living under what they considered to be the tyrannical reign of George III, American colonists feared the spread of a strong centralized executive power. So after America declared its independence, The powers of state governors were weak, and the Articles of Confederation did not create an independent executive branch in the national government.
However, some Americans thought the executive should be strengthened as an independent branch. So, in 1787, the Constitutional Convention was held in an effort to balance powers between the branches of government. The challenges that resulted from having a weak executive under the Articles guided the framers' thinking, though they were at the same time concerned about creating an overly powerful executive.
So I'm going to stop it there because I'm checking the time, but I wanted to make sure that you, that you all saw kind of what the tone was of that. We are really excited about building out our YouTube campaigns. And so if you're interested, if you're able to share YouTube videos, we have over 50 of those homework help videos looking at key Supreme Court cases and key issues. Lastly, I wanted to share just a few of our lessons on e-lessons. So one of the most popular parts of our website is our Teaching with Kern events, which are published every other week. And so they hone right in on what we are talking about on difficult subjects that you can bring to your classrooms immediately. They're usually less than a class period, so they're only about 15 or 20 minutes. They're optimized right now for digital learning. And so we have quite a few on elections and contested elections. The election of 1824, which follows on Curry's love of teaching the election of 1800. If you then jump to the election of 1824, that's the first time that Congress had a role in deciding the president. We also have the Electoral College and the Popular Vote, which again is another great list of resources. It runs you through the activity, a couple of different activities, and then points you to additional readings. So I think I'm going to stop there. We, like I said, at the Bill of Rights Institute are here to serve. We love our educators. We love our educator community. We love the work that Cato is doing, and we're here to support them as we all work to support you all. So if you have any questions, again, my name is Rachel Davison Humphreys. I'm Director of Outreach. You can reach me at the Bill of Rights Institute, and I will turn it back to Alan.
Rachel, thank you so much for the excellent overview and introduction to some of the fantastic resources the Bill of Rights Institute has. And thank you to all of our workshop presenters. I think it's consistently impressive to see how fantastic the different sets of resources and tools each of you bring to the table and the ways in which that can continue civic education for all of our students. What we want to turn to now with about the last 10 minutes or so of our conversation is to dig into that chat, right? So have that Q&A conversation from what you guys put in the questions in the chat and follow up on some of the other pieces. John just shared a short essay on slavery and the Electoral College in the chat, which is a fantastic resource. Do by all means check that out as well. But here in a second, I'm going to pose a question to John and get the conversation going. John, one of the things that you didn't get a chance to talk to earlier was this idea of faithless electors. And that came up a handful of times in our conversation with, in the chat box and in the conversation with the different teachers that are here, particularly given the recent Supreme Court case, Chiafalo versus Washington. I always get the name of that one wrong. But I guess to begin the conversation, John, I'd love to hear a little bit of your thoughts. When it comes to the idea of faithless electors, first of all, what are we talking about? And then two, what are some of the relevant controversies around that topic?
So the question is really whether an elector appointed can vote for someone other than whom they're supposed to vote for. Remember, I said that the dominant rule is winner take all. So in California, and I believe Chiafo was out of Washington, you essentially, both of those states were won by Hillary Clinton. And a faithless elector is one who would vote for someone other. And I believe in Chiafalo case in Washington state, the elector tried to vote for John Kasich, who was then the governor of Ohio. These things happen from time to time. But I want to return to it in a second. There's really no question after Chiafalo, which was decided this year, that states can punish in the case before them. That was a $1,000 fine for not voting for the candidate they were supposed to. States can punish electors who don't. And since for a long time, since Ray versus Blair in 1952, you know, it was this, it's been a constitutional rule that people, they can enforce the requirement of voting. So being, that doesn't mean that states always do it, right? They can do it if they want to. And it makes sense when you think about it. If states are given the power to decide how to allocate the electors, then, and particularly when they do it the way they do it, to have electors do whatever they want is a kind of, it's not a direct contradiction to the Constitution, but it is, fits ill with that, right? However, the, you know, it does harken back to the kind of elite notion in a sense, but not really, because it's not a deliberative institution. Now, what usually happens is somebody in 2000, someone voted for, I believe, Gore or somebody else in a state in the East. Occasionally, there will be faithless electors and they will try to vote for someone else, or they will vote for someone else. The crucial thing is people that study this don't think that will ever matter. And when you think about it, imagine that in 2000, when you had a very close electoral college win for George Bush, imagine that a couple of electors had voted the other way to make Gore president, right? People do it when it doesn't matter. Some, they can be punished for it, but if they did it, there would be immense pressure for them not to do it. And there would be, I mean, I think also the problem would be some people might like you for having done it, but it would be a completely illegitimate act. Your reputation, your rest of your life would be lived out in that you essentially, overthrew an presidential election. So most people think that study this, that one way or the other, it simply wouldn't happen to change an electoral outcome.
It's a fascinating circumstance. One of the other things that has come up, and you touched on some of these elements, but I wanted to follow up on a question that Guy Raz asked, which was on this idea of the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. How likely is something like that to succeed? Are there likely to be court challenges to something along those lines? And similarly, I think you touched on this a little bit. How difficult would it be to amend the Constitution, for example, to support something more like that if it failed in a legislative approach to pass something along those lines?
So the two are connected. National Popular Vote is in a kind of project brought about because the expectation was that the Electoral College was a bad idea and that it couldn't be changed through constitutional amendment. The basic idea is to have a constitutional means for overcoming the Electoral College. And by that, I mean, the Constitution empowers states to form interstate compacts. It also, as I mentioned before, empowers the state legislatures to assign electors in any way they choose, right? So the idea is that states form an interstate compact among themselves, which will come into effect when the total number of electoral votes involved in the compact are 271. That is, you have a winning majority to elect a president. And the substance of the compact is that every state commits themselves, no matter what their own state, whoever their own state voted for, to cast their electoral votes for the National Popular Vote winner, right? So in 2016, if you had it in effect and you had 271 electoral votes in the compact, they would have all cast their votes for Hillary Clinton because she won the National Popular Vote, and she would have been elected president because the electoral compact system would have been turned into a national popular majority vote system. The issues are constitutional. One issue is the concept. Some people say this isn't some. It seems pretty straightforward to me. The Constitution says that Congress has the power to approve interstate compacts. It has to go through Congress, and if you tried to get around it, that would be problematic. And I think actually Congress would reach out and try to pass on it. In other words, the Interstate Compact at issue here would have to go through Congress, and it would probably not get through Congress. That's part one. And if it didn't go through Congress, it'd be unconstitutional. But the real thing I think here is, remember, the idea here is that it doesn't really matter who your state voted for. If you're part of this Interstate Compact, you have to vote for the winner of the national popular vote. The risk here, and they're not simple-minded people, there's sophisticated, smart people that came up with national popular vote. So they have arguments, they have put mechanisms in the system to try to deal with this. But the problem is, if you get into a situation where a state has to vote for and make president a candidate who won the national popular vote, but their state hates, right? So what's going to happen what is likely to happen when that becomes evident around, say, right about this time of year, mid-October or October 20th, is the state legislature or whomever at the state level will start trying to withdraw from the Interstate Compact. And you will have an election day and thereafter in which it will be uncertain how some electoral votes were cast. Now, as I said, they have all kinds of mechanisms in the proposal to try to deal with this, but I think it's just going to be impossible in that situation, in a close election, to prevent a state from withdrawing, or at least to having a gigantic litigation battle in November and December about national popular vote. Now, I think national popular vote was actually intended to show people that, you know, we can go through this, we can have a direct popular vote for the president, and it's not so bad, right? In some ways, that's what happened with the amendment that brought about the popular vote for the Senate. But in this case, I don't think we're getting there. And then, so I'll finish up. I mean, constitutional amendment, 2/3 of Congress, or most likely almost always Congress, 3/4 of the states have to approve of it. As few as 11% of the states, of the population of the United States could form enough states to stop a constitutional amendment. The Republican Party feels very strongly about the Electoral College, as you can see why. And I think the battleground states like Pennsylvania and Ohio and Florida, all of those are not going to want to go to a national party system because they're going to matter less in that system. I'm not even sure, frankly, that there's a majority, let alone 2/3 or 3/4 for going to a national majority system.
So, John, a lot of great questions. I want to try and get through a few of them. So we'll do some rapid fire ones real quick. Irshad Manji, a good friend of the Cato Institute, has asked a great question in the chat. And she asked, does the existence of the Electoral College have implications for preserving the two-party system? As someone who'd be interested to see whether a third or even a fourth party can really gain traction, what's the impact of something like that?
It's generally assumed, and in the past was assumed to be a benefit. Some people might think of it as a cost, as helping support the two-party system here. And you can see why. If you vote for a third or fourth party candidate, it is generally assumed because of the state electoral system that you are wasting your vote, right? One of the two major party candidates is going to win, so you should choose between those two because you might have a chance of winning in a competitive state there. The third party vote is just said to be wasted or sort of a rhetorical or just to show you don't like the other two, but it really can affect who wins office and policymaking thereafter. So yes, it's not the only thing that supports the two-party system, but it definitely has strong effects.
Excellent. Another great question. One of our teachers noted that there's a complexity when it comes to trying to understand things like primaries, delegates, superdelegates, and the different rules between the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. John, do you know of, or for our colleagues from the civic education organizations, any good resources that help explain what those different rules look like and how people can start to understand it, especially in a way that will be easy to explain to students?
You know, I used to have a, I do have a friend in DC, and every morning, every Saturday morning, it was like 8 a.m. or something, he would go down to some place just off the Capitol and attend the meeting of the Republican National Committee Rules Committee for the presidency. It was like very hard to do and nobody wanted to go down there, but he knew that these were very important. But the people making the rules also knew they didn't want a bunch of people there. They wanted to make the rules. So my answer would be, complex for many reasons, but it's gonna be hard to find out what they are. He was a guy who, the proverbial dog that bites the leg and never gives up. And that's what you're going to need to find out the party rules.
All right. One more question, and then I'll let you offer any closing thoughts that you have, John. Curry asks, I think, which is a fun one, what about ranked choice voting, right? So instead of using something like the winner-take-all system, there's been some discussion, and especially a few states experimenting around this idea of moving toward ranked choice voting. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that, and what are some of the potential implications of a system like that?
Well, I used to be pretty negative about it because I thought something like it happened afterwards. Now I'm much more affirmative. I think the interesting thing it does is this business about wasting your vote goes away, because you can, if you want to vote for a third or fourth party candidate, you can do that. You can rank them in your system. And in a sense, that they will matter to the, and presumably.
Share a little bit about your thinking and to really engage in the conversation. Like I said, we'll be following up shortly after this with an email following up with all of you, sharing many of the great resources that Curry, Emma, and Rachel shared with you, as well as making sure that we keep you in touch with all the latest opportunities and what's coming around with this broader sphere project. Again, thank you all so much. It's been a pleasure. Enjoy the rest of your evening.